to Tea, Tonic, and Toxin, a book club and podcast for anyone who wants to explore the best mysteries and thrillers ever written. I'm your host, Sarah Harrison.
And I'm your host, Carolyn Daughters. Pour yourself a cup of tea, a gin and tonic,
but not a toxin,
and join us on a journey through 19th and 20th century mysteries and thrillers, every one of them a game changer. Sarah.
What on earth have we been talking about?
We are talking about Trent's Last Case by E.C. Bentley, which may be the first Golden Age detective novel.
That's cool. We need to spend some time defining the Golden Age,
I think we're going to talk about the Golden Age, and I'm going to estimate 452 other things.
Yes. Rounding up.
Yes.
But before we do that, we want to shout out to our listener of the episode. Our listener this episode is Emily Schwartz from Chicago, Illinois.
Awesome.
Emily has been listening to the podcast and even answering questions we asked, like, what should our closing line be?
And where have we landed, Sarah?
We're going to stay mysterious for a while.
Stay mysterious. Better than, I would argue, stay toxic.
I don't know. What do you think, listeners?
Weigh in. Do you like stay mysterious? Did you like stay toxic, which we did try out for multiple episodes?
I mean, stay tea doesn't even make sense.
No. And if you have other suggestions, share them with us. We will probably do something. I don't know.
Emily's getting a sticker for her contributions.
Sticker. Tell us about the sticker.
They're super sweet. They're gorgeous. They have our logo, our website. And coming up, they'll be sent out in some beautiful, fun-to-receive sticker packages in the mail.
I cannot wait to see these sticker packages.
Yeah. Well, maybe you should comment on the website, Carolyn.
I'm going to actually leave the podcast right now. I'll be back in a moment, but I want to get this sticker packet.
Yeah, as you should. All right. Thank you, Emily. And thank you, Carolyn Daughters, who is our sponsor today. Carolyn Daughters runs a brand building and communications consultancy. She leads brand therapy workshops, teaches marketing courses for startups and small businesses, and teaches persuasive writing courses. Carolyn and her team empower startups, small businesses, enterprise, and government agencies to win hearts, minds, deals, and dollars. You can learn more at carolyndaughters.com.
Awesome. So we have talked about Trent's Last Case in our last podcast. In our last podcast episode, we have so much to say. We have two podcast episodes, and we do like to start with a summary of what happens in this book, because, listener, you don't have to read the book before you listen to our podcast.
I mean, you should. It's not very long. But if you didn't, if you don't want to,
it's okay. We have enough to say that it'll be like you're reading the book. So in less than an hour, you'll get the gist of the book, plus something equally valuable, our take on it, and you won't even have to read the book.
Equally or more valuable.
So before we get into how Trent's Last Case may be one of the, if not the first, Golden Age detective novel, I want to sum it up here a little bit. Trent's Last Case is a murder mystery by E.C. Bentley. The story begins when wealthy, ruthless American business magnate Sigsbee Manderson is found shot dead outside his English country house. Philip Trent is sent to the West Country to report on the case. Trent is a journalist, famed artist, and socialite with a reputation as a detective who can outthink Scotland Yard. When Trent arrives on the scene, he views the body and examines the house and grounds. He talks to Manderson's wife, Mabel, and his two secretaries, American Calvin Bunner and Englishman John Marlowe. Trent also runs into his friend, Nathaniel Couples, who is Mabel's uncle by marriage. During his three-day investigation, Trent is puzzled by many strange events that occurred on the night of Manderson's murder, including the fact that he wasn't wearing his false teeth and the fact that no one heard anything. Trent believes Marlowe and Mabel are in love, and that Marlowe shot Manderson and came up with a clever plan to give him an alibi, give himself an alibi. Trent confronts Mabel, and her reaction tells him he's right. Because Trent is in love with Mabel, he gives her his report instead of giving it to his newspaper. 6 months later, Trent sees Mabel in London. She says she and Marlowe were never intimate, though her husband had been suspicious. In no time at all, they become engaged. Next, Trent and Nathaniel Couples meet with Marlowe. Marlowe says Manderson fabricated incriminating evidence to implicate Marlowe and then shot himself as an act of revenge. Just in time, Marlowe had realized what was happening and covered his tracks. Afterward, Couples reveals what really happened on the night of the murder. Couples had found Manderson pointing a pistol at himself. Couples had tried to take the gun away and ended up firing the fatal shot. It turns out Trent got it all wrong. The book ends with Trent vowing he'll never touch a crime mystery again. In the book, E.C. Bentley was supposedly trying to create an anti-Sherlock Holmes. When it was published in 1913, it was considered one of the most influential detective novels ever written. P.D. James even says it might have been the first Golden Age detective novel. Today, we're excited to talk about Trent's Last Case, our second book selection of 2023. You can find our entire list of books for 2023 on our website at tetonicandtoxin.com.
Awesome. Uh-huh. We left off in our last episode talking about the nature, I would say, of Mabel and Trent's love. Mm-hmm. I felt like... yes, it is. It was kind of derailing, and not in the way that the first Sherlock, A Study in Scarlet, was, right? That took a major shift into a whole nother story right in the middle of the book. But I liked it. I thought it worked well. Mm-hmm. Shifting into, like, how does Trent live his life now without the woman he loves who might possibly be a co-conspirator in a murder?
I have a question here before we get too deep. I want to hear, Sarah, what you think about love at first sight. Trent sees this woman. He's sent on site to this country house to investigate this crime, this murder, or potential murder, by a publication. Along the way, in passing, he sees Mabel Manderson, the widow. And in 3 days of flitting, very short periods of time of interaction and engagement, he falls in love with her. Am I just not a romantic person? What am I missing? Is this a thing?
Have you never felt any love at first sight at all? Like, never had that feeling?
No.
Really?
You have felt love at first sight.
I mean, at this point in my life, I wouldn't, like, squeeze the word love into it. But I did, I kind of reviewed that with myself because, yeah, it's that first sighting that Trent does before he even knows it's Mabel. And he sees this woman and she's, like, so beautiful and she's, like, she just looks radiant as she's, like, gazing out over the countryside. And he's just, like,
attraction at first sight, or like at first sight, or inclined to think highly of person at first sight.
Well, and I think that's what it is. I mean, that's what I think the phenomenon is. But so I was kind of racking my brain here. And there's certainly, like, connection at first sight that goes beyond the normal.
Okay.
Like, I would say maybe twice in my life it happened to me. And it was really weird. And I'm a weirdo. The very first time I remember. And it sticks in your brain.
Yeah.
I was this high school student, and I think that's kind of like the susceptible age for it. And I was at the gym, you know, working out with my family. We were all workouters. And I was in high school, so we'd go to the gym like every Tuesday and Thursday. And this kid walks in, and there was some weird, weird connection. Like, I almost fainted. And in fact, I was such a freak, I hid from him the whole night. I did. He would, like, I could see him trying to come up to me and talk to me. It was, okay, like a weird electric connection. And I could see that he felt the exact same thing. And he would try and talk to me. And I would go hide behind the file cabinet. And I'm like, what is the matter with you, Sarah? You idiot. Hmm. And
how old were you?
17.
Okay.
I don't know.
Okay.
High school age.
Yeah, 17.
And I looked for him every Tuesday and Thursday for like the next several years. Oh. I tried to even come at off times. He never came back. It must have just been a free trial.
Wow.
But for years. You know, it was so bizarre.
If you had seen him on a subsequent visit, would you have hidden back behind that file cabinet?
I might have. I had a lot of weird anxiety, which when I look back now, I'm just like, oh my goodness, mm-hmm. you needed help, Sarah. but, you know, at the time, I don't know what I would have done. Possibly. In my mind, I would have spoken to him and actually just let him ask me out or something.
But. Sure. Eventually.
Yeah, it was a weird, overwhelming feeling, and I went and hid behind a file cabinet for like half an hour. So. Yeah.
Okay.
So that was weird. But I was thinking back about Victorian times, right, where people did get married after a couple weeks, a couple months, an arranged marriage almost. My father wanted me to marry this person.
Some guy shows up at the door with a calling card. Has tea four times, and then the fifth time he comes by, he asks for the woman's hand in marriage.
And I feel like in Victorian times, if you got a sensation like love at first sight, you were lucky to even have that. It probably felt like love.
Yes.
Because you didn't have if you married them. It wasn't arranged. It wasn't like, okay, we were in the same social circle, and my parents approved this, and we've danced.
But it also wasn't necessarily a meeting of the minds. It wasn't as if the two people necessarily sit down and share their view of the world or their goals in life. I would love to live in the country, or I want to stay in London the rest of my life. A large family is what I want. I don't know that they sat down and really explored what each of them wanted in
not. Life. It's like, you know, it's Victorian times. You got married in 2 months. That's how it works. You've met each other, you liked each other, you make an agreement. You're lucky if you feel like this buzzing feeling of love. And so I kind of think that it's maybe a little bit stuck in hinging on this rather juvenile feeling and take. What you get when you're a kid.
And so we're comparing Philip Trent to a 17-year-old.
Yeah, which absolutely.
Doesn't feel... For me, watching how he is so doe-eyed and just completely overtaken by this woman, her presence, her existence, you hinted at this a little bit in the last podcast episode, but he runs into her 6 months after he drops his
runs
report.
Into her on purpose.
Yeah, so I mean, talk about. That seemed a little strange.
Well,
he heard
she was back in London, and so he just like went to London and started hanging out at places that she would hang out at.
Yeah.
Until they bumped into each other, mm-hmm. and then it was like almost a literal bump. I feel like there she was, touching his arm, and
yes.
And then they continued.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't think it's like substantial or great, but also I didn't find it like out of the ordinary. Yeah, I was just trying to think back. Well, what were some of the other love stories? And we already talked about how annoying I found the one in The Woman in White. Mm-hmm. And Sherlock has no love interest going on, but except with himself, perhaps. And then there was, I looked up John Jarndyce and Esther in Bleak House and how inappropriate that was.
That was, for me, that's a really hard scene when John Jarndyce, who is... at least twice her age, maybe more.
Yeah.
And is Esther Summerson's guardian. When he basically proposes marriage to her, it is so uncomfortable for me
to read. Well, and he kind of alludes to the fact that he became her guardian with potentially that in mind. It was probably my favorite book we read last year.
It's a great. It's my favorite Dickens, and it's a stunner of a book.
It's one of those things to where sometimes I just have to suspend myself for a minute and be like, different times.
Right.
And times are different not that long ago. Mm-hmm. So one of the authors I like, Eudora Welty, mm-hmm. you're probably familiar with her. And one of her books, her short stories, talks about how, and this was like, you know, within one lifetime out of the South, your goal was, like, the best thing you could do was to grow up and marry your first cousin. That was what, that was the best possible outcome you could have, that you and your first cousin would fall in love. And I was like, whoo, different times. Not even legal now.
But, yeah.
And that was just, you know, a lifetime ago. Eudora Welty only recently passed. And then I think multiply that by a few lifetimes. And there's going to be a lot of stuff I find hard to wrap my head around.
Right.
And I do think the Victorians are in many ways a little bit kind of naive in love.
And so I would agree with that. And now we're in, I think, 1913.
Okay, so they're not Victorian anymore. No. What would they be?
They would be of the modern period of literature, or maybe modernist period. It's pre-World War One. So, and it's, I mean, arguably also, you know, we've said maybe this was the first Golden Age detective novel. We're entering the early stages of the golden age of the detective story at this point. Most people would put those years as the 20s and 30s, but P.D. James and other writers suggest that Trent's Last Case falls into this sort of precursor to those books because it does so many things those other books will be doing.
What defines the golden age? So our whole year this year is a lot about the golden age of detective novels. What defines that?
So it's going to change book to book and perspective to perspective, but think Agatha Christie and think Dorothy Sayers. So you have an upper class murder. You don't have
an upper class murder.
Yeah, you don't have a Jack the Ripper in the streets with the prostitute murder. You have an upper class inhabitants of a English country house. It's usually secluded somewhere, owned by the family, inhabited by the family. The murder occurs there. There are all these different red herrings. We think it's this person. Oh no, it's possibly that person. Oh, got it wrong again. Clues are going to have discrepancies. We're going to have to figure out what's right and what's wrong, what's true and what's false. There's this closed circle of suspects. So this is not an episode of Law and Order where the detectives go around and try to figure out who in the entire city of New York could possibly have committed this crime. It's who in this house of the seven people in here.
Like a game of Clue.
Like a game of Clue, and also like the Glass Onion, the movie.
Oh yeah, we're going to be talking about that in an upcoming episode.
We are, yeah. It's a hearkening back to the Golden Age, in that it's a very wealthy subset of the population in this secluded house. A murder is committed. We think it's this person and we find out we're wrong, and we keep going down these different rabbit holes. There's many red herrings. There's the closed circle of suspects, and often the least likely culprit is the villain. And so we find that in Trent's Last Case.
That's true. I think it is fair to say first Golden Age detective novel.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I feel like it fits a lot of those criteria, and it's on the front end of it. So it's doing something different than a lot of the Golden Age detective novels are. One of the things it's doing differently is Trent has this big romance with Mabel Manderson. Dorothy Sayers and other writers are in awe of this book and praise it to the hilt. But they do also say, I feel like the detective should focus on detecting.
What do you mean? You mean in their own novels? Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that the love story becomes a distraction, and it also changes the tone and tenor of the book itself.
Although Sayers in her introduction really loved the love story.
That's interesting, yeah.
Yeah, she did. She loved a lot of this stuff, and I think that, so I saved her introduction till the end, and I think reading it at the end kind of, it almost made a lens through which I interpreted a lot of this stuff. Mm-hmm. For example, we were talking about like how pretentious he sounds when he's just like randomly quoting poetry. And she actually quotes one of the parts that I thought sounded like kind of annoying in the book. She says, but what about the delicious irrelevancies of the dialogue? And then she quotes that whole thing about the hotel sitting room. Do you remember that part? The greatest thing about a hotel sitting room is that its beauty does not distract the mind from work. Oh. And he goes along saying how he's sat in this sitting room like hundreds of times. And I just like, I mean, I get it. You're being clever. I suppose this is funnier to your audience than it necessarily is to me, but I get it. And she goes on, undramatic? Too fanciful? Too literary? Possibly. But to lose things like that is to lose the whole savor of the thing. And if any such mayhem is committed on Trent's last case, there will be another murder done. So she was quite attached to some of the
I'm going to push back on one thing there in particular. A book is not necessarily literary simply because someone quotes from Tennyson and Shelley and Sir Walter Scott. It's literary if the story, the characters, the language move you. And if after you put the thing down, you're still thinking about it afterward, if it warrants a reread, I'm really glad I read this book, but I'm not rereading it.
Yeah, I mean, I don't disagree with that. But Sayers finds it very literary. And so I'm thinking if she does, then...
That settles probably. It. She's not coming to my dinner party either.
Probably I'm taking it in its times. Like, for the time, it was considered very literary, and that's the way literary people wrote things. And, I mean, he pulled it off with probably someone considered to be, like, much greater than his contemporary. So, yeah. I don't know. That's where, so that I kind of am using her lens a little bit, I would say, as I look through the book, because...
The,
I don't know.
The tone in this book shifts so dramatically. The very first pages, we hear about this ruthless business magnate, Sigsbee Manderson. And then we get into the detective story, which I found probably the most engaging chunk of the book. Then we move into the love story portion, where there's still this thread of the detective story floating around. And then we get to the denouement at the end, where we figure out what really happened. It felt like several different books sort of cobbled together a little bit to me.
I found the part, too, about the love story. It was really... Did you read this intro that she wrote?
I think I did.
Yeah, it was really interesting, because she's like imagining when it becomes a radio program. Mm. So again, that's the period we are. It's going to be made into a radio program. And she goes... The purely detective part, that is straightforward enough. I hope they will not make a mess of Trent's love scene with Mrs. Manderson. And then she quotes, you know, look at me. It is the sight of the century. One who says he loves you, blah, 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 et cetera, et cetera. Which,
I have the same, I've got the word false. Up at the top.
Yeah, like Dorothy Sayers loved it.
Yeah.
So she's not reading melodrama in it. She found it
interesting. What I wrote. So she says, Trent's last case is supremely well written without ever straying too far from the plot or getting out of key with the general tone of the book. And I wrote false in the margin.
yeah. So... I just think it's funny that here I am trying to be the one that's like, well, I'm trying to take it in the time period it's written in and how people of the time might have considered it. And now Carolyn's being kind of like the I don't like it hothead, which is where I usually see myself.
I felt the author's hand. A good story, you forget who's writing it. You forget what their agenda was. Every writer has an agenda because we're living, breathing human beings. You get into the story, and then at some point, the hour's late, the light is dimming, you have work the next day, you have to put the thing down. I felt the author's hand here, and I was too conscious of it as I was reading, and so I was never able to fully dive into this story.
That's funny. Because that is exactly how I felt about Wilkie Collins.
not both. Well,
so no, I like the Moonstone, but when I was reading The Woman in White, I was just like, oh my goodness, I cannot get over like his treatment of women here. Mm-hmm. And you were kind of like, well, I don't know that it was necessarily him. You know, that's the characters he was writing. I was like, yeah, but it's his hero character. Right. It really feels like this is him. But, you know, I don't know, and I'll never know.
Yeah.
For sure.
So this book shares a trait with other books that are going to follow. So let's say it is the first Golden Age detective novel. Other Golden Age novels written by Agatha Christie and others are going to share this particular trait, which you and I discussed a little bit offline, casual racism.
Oh, yeah. That was really interesting. And I had forgotten a part, so I'm glad you kind of reminded me, especially that was an interesting part. So I'm going to read this part. Marlowe says, I used to think that Manderson's strain of Indian blood, remote as it was, might have something to do with the cunning and ruthlessness of the man. And I thought, okay, well, oops. And I did remember the part where he, like, swore him to secrecy. Mm-hmm. Like, he was ashamed of having Native American blood and didn't want anyone to know it. And I was like, okay, so Manderson is a racist. And that sort of portrayed in a poor light that he would try and hide that, I felt like. But then this part where Marlowe's kind of, you know, trying to detective things himself and kind of tracing his cunning and ruthlessness to being an Indian, I was like, oh, okay, yeah, that's...
So you see casual racism. I'm not going to make E.C. Bentley out to be some sort of outlier. Agatha Christie does it as well. Other writers of the period are doing it and going to continue doing it. And heads up, this is going to continue through the 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s.
I think through current times.
Well, maybe.
I feel like I still read it in not maybe mainstream books written by white Americans, but I've read it in other books, I would say.
And also our understanding of what is respectful. So things we say can be racist or not racist. Sometimes we're working to not be racist. Mm-hmm. I don't want to be racist, but sometimes I don't always know what I'm doing wrong. Mm-hmm. I would know not to say certain words. I'm not stupid. I know I've put thought and time and attention in reading and conversation with people, but I'm not always going to know. So I might make thoughtless statements. At times, I think writers will do this. Thoughtful writers who are trying will do this. And as long as we're, as a people, open to the conversation where somebody could say to us, you know, what you wrote here or said here is a problem. Can I tell you why? And then I can hear it and understand it and grow from it. I think that's great. When it's just casually dropped in, as E.C. Bentley does in this book, I get bothered by it. It has nothing to do with the plot, the instances when he uses the N-word, when he talks about, you know, maybe he's savage and ruthless and bloody because he has Indian blood in him. These references don't go anywhere. They could literally be edited out of the next edition of the book and no one would know.
If they knew what they were doing, which I would think maybe not, because the book, I think in another vein, has kind of this interesting Englishman versus American type of thing. Mm-hmm. And on one hand, they'll say like these very flattering things about Americans are so clever, Americans are this or that. And I think that gets attributed to Indian blood as well. They'll be like, you know, the people that moved over there early, there's so much intermarriage, you know, almost everyone has Indian blood in America. Mm-hmm. And then just, you know, they're so clever and they're always going for it and they're always coming up with a million ideas. And we English, we just don't. And
yes.
So I do think there's an aspect of the book where he is sort of considering this American versus English mentality. And he's probably thinking that this is a legitimate factor of discussion. Yeah. I'm thinking, like, I really don't feel like he was going out of his way. Mm-hmm. But I also, I don't know, maybe I'm just being overly generous.
Right. So there are American characters in the book. Two prime examples are Sigsbee Manderson and
Bunner.
Bunner, Calvin Bunner. They don't, I mean, the author chose to put two American characters in there. The author's always choosing who to populate the book with. The author has a story they want to tell. They're going to put characters in. The characters are going to interact with each other in various ways that hopefully move the story forward. The author could have just put a cast of English characters. So the first question is, why are Calvin Bunner and Sigsbee Manderson American? So my two possibilities there are, in authorial intention, he wanted to put Americans in there to say something about who Americans are, or the range of possibilities, and how they potentially differ from English men and women. Or the author just thought it'd be fun. That there's lack of authorial intent. He just thought, I know some American guys. I'm going to put somebody in the book who resembles this guy I know, this buddy of mine, or this...
It feels a little bit intentional to me, just because of all the American comparisons. He throws in American authors, he throws in American mm-hmm. people, but also American millionaires. And that mm-hmm. I think that could be a factor as well, because people would get really rich mm-hmm. as sort of these American oligarchs. And even today, so I was working with a Canadian recruiter, and he made an interesting offhanded comment about the salaries you see in America. He just does not see anywhere else, not in Canada. And then, you know, both of us had just recently, he had had his first baby and I'd had my second.
Yeah.
And so, like, leave in Canada is much different mm-hmm. than leave in America.
Yeah.
And so that's kind of where he was kind of thinking along the lines of, well, you have these health benefits we have here and you don't have them there, but man, the salaries you have there, I've just never seen anything like it mm-hmm. for his recruiting. And I wonder if it is possibly an interesting phenomenon, mm-hmm. especially at the time. It's where you have the rise of these magnates, and, you know, there was this other comparison. There's the American and English comparisons going on. Yeah. But then he had also this other comparison of, like, the super rich versus the artists.
Yeah.
And that's one of the things I did not like about Mabel. It's like she kind of mourns her marriage because, I just didn't get to hang out with meaningful people. They were just these rich people, and they just were boring and unartistic and had no heart.
She also says, back when I was poor and I wanted to not be poor and I wanted to be wealthy, I didn't realize that I'd be hearkening back to that time thinking, oh, that was so fun when we would take the train and we would go with no money. And
yeah.
So we romanticize sometimes the other thing wherever we're not.
Yeah. Yeah. And just kind of disparage where you are. And I'm like, okay, well, you're like the richest person in the world. So. Yeah.
It's hard to feel sorry for
maybe
her.
You have some ownership in your situation. Yeah. but yeah, so I feel like that was a contrast. He was standing up, and are all those contrasts helpful?
Yeah.
I wonder, you know, or is it just a period that we've moved through and we think about things different now? Like at the time.
Right.
These thoughts were arising. They were creating these contrasts they wanted to discuss. Mm-hmm. And they've moved through them, and now they feel like fairly rude or inappropriate.
Yeah, I mean, so because, you know, we're talking about this as being the first Golden Age detective novel, or at least potentially, there's this landed class that has inherited wealth. And generally speaking, in the country houses and all of that in England, these are families holding on to what their families gave them. This is a small class of people. Now we have this American guy who's sort of emulating the English landed class. He's not.
Yeah, that confused me for a while.
Honestly. Yeah, he's not the same ilk. He's self-made. He's, I think, from New York. So, but he comes and he lives in this big country house. So he, for all intents and purposes, is trying to mirror that whole lifestyle. But, you know, you see in Downton Abbey that sort of push and pull of the inherited wealth, and suddenly the inherited wealth starts dissipating. There's a lot of family members that need to get this wealth, and the land is either taken over or doesn't have the same value or isn't worked, or all of these things happen, and that wealth is not, doesn't have the permanency it was once thought to have. That sort of clash, I think, is key to the Golden Age. And then after the Golden Age, we're going to get, you know, post-World War II, for example, and then onward, I don't think we're as interested in hearing about this family that inherited the estate in Hertfordshire or wherever. I don't think we're as interested in that. I think we're interested in a different, more modern, grittier, more human, more real story.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I'm looking forward to all of these Golden Age books. Yeah. I didn't actually know it existed as an age. And I like that it's kind of making a resurgence now. And things like Glass Onion, and we talked about some other kind of movies and TV shows that are kind of like a whodunit sort of approach that seems to be coming up a lot.
Yeah. There's this really interesting statement in the book that I wanted to talk about the certainty of achievement.
Mm-hmm.
And the quote really hit me. So I'll read it, and then I want to hear, Sarah, what you have to say. So there are moments in the life when we become conscious of a fortunate thing ordained. Who does not know when, what it is to feel at times that success is at hand? The general suddenly knows at dawn that the day will bring him victory. The man on the green suddenly knows that he will put down the long putt. As Trent mounted the stairway, he seemed to rise into certainty of achievement. And when I read that, I thought that was really interesting because I have felt that way periodically.
Yeah.
Not often. I wish it were often. Have you ever felt that where you enter into something important? And you feel it in your gut, your head, your heart, your gut. Like, this is it, and this works.
Yeah, I'm struggling with that one personally. I can't think of any times.
Okay. Yeah.
I really want to have that feeling, and it sounds like a lovely feeling, and I almost get that it ought to be a feeling, and I'm left with a feeling that maybe I have more work to do before my brain. The feeling I usually feel is like the other shoe's about to drop. Mm. Like, when is it going to drop? Like, things have been going my way for a moment, so catastrophe's at hand. That's usually my haunting feeling, and that's very interesting.
But also, he's wrong.
Yes.
So in this particular instance, he knows everything's going to go his way, but it doesn't because he is wrong. We find out at the end, he thought it was Marlowe who had committed the murder, and it was actually Nathaniel Couples. And some of the times when I have felt this certainty in my gut, I know where I am and what I'm doing is right, spot on. I know it. I'm often wrong.
Really?
Yeah.
Huh, that's so interesting.
There's not a one-to-one correlation between for Philip Trent and for me for feeling I got this and actually getting this.
That's nice you get the feeling, though. It sounds like a delightful feeling.
Yeah.
Instead of always being haunted that what's going to happen next.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. And then he also expresses this very human sense of fear, which really resonated with me. Maybe you could read that quote.
Yeah, I liked that. So the only thing that held Trent back was fear of an unfamiliar task. To react against fear had become a fixed moral habit with him. So tell me about that.
Yeah, so fear holds you back, and so in many cases we don't do whatever the thing is that we fear. However, I believe Eleanor Roosevelt said at some point, or wrote, or thought, or someone attributed to her, do one thing every day that scares you. That has always resonated with me. I was born on the same day, not the same year, as Eleanor Roosevelt. So I've always adored Eleanor Roosevelt and found great wisdom in a lot of her sayings and writings. And I almost always do one thing every day that scares me.
Oh, that's awesome.
Now, that doesn't mean I'm jumping from an airplane every day, or, you know, picking some weird stock to invest in, or I'm not going crazy trying something new each day. Sometimes they're really small things that I'm doing.
Like what? What's an example?
Sometimes it's, I need to go to a networking event. I know I need I have to go to it. I know three people who are going to be there that I absolutely need to see in person, because when I see them in person, I'm going to seal the deal. Whereas we can email till the end of time and Zoom all day long, and it's not the same as if I'm in the room with them and we just, you know, lock eyes and shake hands. And for the life of me, I am not a networker. I'm not wired that way. Don't enjoy it. The whole thing, it takes every ounce of my energy. But I get dressed up and I go. And I'm constantly doing things that in my perfect world I would not do if I think that it's worthwhile and that my fear is impeding me. Another example is I'm terrified of heights. And airplanes.
Oh, really?
I fly all the time.
Yeah, you're always traveling.
Yes. Terrified. Terrified at the sense that if the plane is rocky at all, we have turbulence, I'm literally sweating. It's rolling down my face. I'm terrified. Most people, I would argue, who are as terrified as I am, don't board the plane.
I like that one, too. That one did resonate with me, whereas, like, the feeling of certainty doesn't. Mm-hmm. I very much, in my head, I don't use the language of fear. What I say in my head is hard.
Yeah.
So when something's really hard, or to react against things that I find really hard, which probably incorporates fear and maybe other things too, but almost I would say I've wondered if it's to a fault, and that's something I debate with myself a lot, you know. So for example, some of my favorite classes in school were literature classes. My worst class in high school was physics. So guess what I have a degree in?
Mm-hmm. I'm guessing it's literature.
No, it's physics. And I've often wondered, like, what are you doing? And not only is it physics, it's physics after I went to art school, dropped out, and I'm taking calculus level physics and realizing, you know, I hadn't taken math in like 4 years at all, like zero math. I'm realizing I can't remember how to do fractions, and I'm in calculus level physics, and it was very scary.
Yeah.
And it was very hard. and I just studied all the time, around the clock. And, you know, I've wondered oftentimes, like, what if you did something, Sarah, that came naturally instead of always trying to force yourself against like a wave? And I haven't come to a conclusion, because you do have these, not just Eleanor Roosevelt, but a lot of people in the world. And there are a lot of benefits to doing things you find hard and scary. And should you model your whole life's course on that? I don't know. Or should you try and, like, you know, there's a whole nother body of work around leveraging your strengths.
Yeah.
And what that can bring you. So
I'm more of a strengths, you know, leveraging person. if someone wants me to design, to do design, I can do design. I mean, not complex mm-hmm. design, but I created our pretty little logo.
It's gorgeous.
And our website. And so I have a visual sense, but there are people who are faster and better at it than I am. Mm-hmm. So my choices are dig in, learn everything I can, pour hours into it, get better, 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 or let people who are better at it do most of it.
Mm-hmm.
I've chosen path B because the areas that make my eyes light up and get me excited about my day are not designing things. It's writing, it's communication, it's teaching people how to communicate better. It's really asking the hard questions and pulling from people, from books, from online sources, the real information, getting to the truth. Understanding who somebody is at their core, whether it's an individual or a company, what is their identity, not design. So tackling every single possible challenge is not interesting to me.
Yeah, there's always a balance to be struck, mm-hmm. right? There's the amazing growth you can have as a person when you're doing hard things. Mm-hmm. And there's the exhaustion that you feel when all you're doing are things that do not come naturally yes. to you all of the time. And I definitely have been, I think, probably on that side of it more often than I care to be.
And you're also an entrepreneur. So you are wearing 10 hats. 8 of them are inelegant and don't fit well. That's the life of the entrepreneur, right?
Right.
It's how you start the business. It's your ability to be scrappy and do all of those things as necessary. You figure it out. So that's a skill set. It does require a lot of energy of almost anyone doing it, which is why most people don't become entrepreneurs.
Yeah. Well, and you know, when's the last time I got to paint a painting? Which is something that
right.
I love, that gets me in my real like weird head zone. Mm-hmm. It's been years.
Yeah.
I'm planning all so many paintings that I have not got to execute. And so that can be certainly a little bit draining. But, well, before we close, there was one more on here that I wanted to really hit. And that is womanliness.
Okay.
So we've seen in a lot of our books, and this one's no exception, sort of this contrast between the womanly woman and the modern woman. Mm-hmm. And I'm just sort of inferring here during these time periods, based on the criticisms we're hearing about, that there's this English athletic woman and she's not womanly and they don't like her. But Mabel is described as being extremely womanly.
Mm-hmm.
But for the life of me, I don't know what that means in this instance. And the woman in white, it almost means incompetent. But it does. Yeah. Everything that Marianne does that is logical and straightforward, mm-hmm. from her handshake to her look in your eye, yeah. that's masculine.
Yeah.
But everything you do that's like completely incompetent and irrational, that's mm-hmm. feminine.
Yes.
All right, so I get it in that book. Mm-hmm. But in this one, I'm not entirely sure.
Yeah.
What is so womanly
about Mabel?
Or in general, I mean, why is Mabel womanly? What is womanly here?
Well, so she is our main female character. I'm trying to think of other female characters. There's the French maid,
mm-hmm.
who apparently is quite attractive, and also she reminded me of Hortense in
yes.
Bleak House.
Yes, the other French murdering maid.
Which I guess that's a stereotype, I guess. Mm-hmm. A character you just drop in.
The French maid.
Hot-headed French maid based on Hortense from Bleak House.
Or I don't know, based on French maids. I don't know. They had them, right? Because the French were always the style leaders.
So French maids, you can reach Sarah at teatonicandtoxin.com.
No, but the French were. They were leading in style at the time. And so I'm just imagining all these English ladies getting their French maids to
yes.
French them up.
Yes, but the English ladies are all about decorum and the French maids are all about marching, as Hortense does, I think, through the grass at some point barefoot
yes.
with her skirts yes. hiked up because she's so angry.
Very passionate.
Yes. You would never see Esther Summerson in Bleak House.
Absolutely not.
Or Laura from...
Laura would catch a brain fever and she'd be out for 2 months.
Yes. And maybe not Mabel Manderson. I don't know.
I don't know. I honestly can't figure this Mabel out. I don't know what's so womanly about her.
Yeah, I don't know. It's overwhelming to him. It sort of intimidates him. Trent. Yeah, it's very odd, but I think it's sort of shorthand for, hey, reader, I need you to understand that she was so captivating that he's going to fall in love with her in 5 seconds flat, and we're going to base the entire second half of the book on this. So I need you to nod your head, reader. You're nodding? Good.
That's funny. All right. Well, what do we have coming up next?
Next.
Another Golden Age novel.
Right. So if this is the first Golden Age detective novel, we're going to see the next one is The 39 Steps by John. Oh, I wish I knew how to say this man's name. Buchan?
Buchan? Buchan? It's another one that the letters feel wrong.
Yes. Sarah, tell us what happens in The 39 Steps.
When a spy is murdered in Richard Hannay's London flat, can Hannay manage to stay one step ahead of his pursuers? The story is an early example of the man on the run adventure. Oh, I'm excited. Mm-hmm. It's also a shocker that combines personal and political dramas. You can buy a copy on Amazon, find a copy at your favorite local or online news bookstore, or read it for free, courtesy of Project Gutenberg. Check out our page on the 39 steps at tetonicandtoxina.com and share your thoughts on our website if you want a sticker. And obviously, subscribe to the podcast.
Subscribe to the podcast so you never miss an episode. You can also find us on Facebook and Instagram at Tetonic and Toxin.
Where you can give us 5 stars.
Where you can give, and it just makes sense. I mean, yes.
What else are you doing?
If you visit our website and go to the page for the 39 steps, we have a page there. We're going to put we actually already have conversation starters on that page.
Okay.
I forgot. We are ahead of it. Could be anyone. You'll find conversation starters there and links to Amazon so you can easily purchase a book. And at zero cost to you, if you buy the book through our website, you get a little bit of a kickback, which helps us fund
5 cents or something.
It's about 5.5 cents, but technology is expensive and we're funding this labor of love, and it would be a small way for you to give back a little bit with zero cost to you. So win-win. Sarah, take us out.
All right. Thank you, listeners. And until next time, stay mysterious.